Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show.
How's it going?
Good. You're really excited today, aren't you?
I am. Actually, I'm in a really great mood.
That's good. Yeah. I did enjoy that theatrical guitar playing.
Did you like how I just did like one string pick?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it was it was real good. I wish you could see this via podcast.
I know, right?
Finger.
We'll have to do a vodcast. Or just for that one move.
I don't like all these
words
combining together. You could just say video.
Could do cast. A video of you being...
Yeah, I mean, I think one day I could do noises for something. I really wish I could do the special effect noises for our videos.
Why don't you?
Because I think they're easier to get offline.
Oh, well, that's too bad. I think it'd be fun if you just decided to like clump some coconut shells together.
Be like, Philip, let me do the sounds. That's my horse.
I like it because we have so many charities that we talk to with horses.
Hey, there is some.
There are, yeah.
They also help with wildfires.
Fact.
Fact.
All right, welcome to episode 11 of season 2. We're talking about World AIDS Day today. Mm-hmm. And instead of program manager Philip Kerrigan, it is I, Heather Lucas.
It is I.
Hello. Heather Lucas, I'm the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Combined Fund Drive. And today, joining me is...
Jerrica Ferguson, handling marketing and development for the Combined Fund Drive.
Yeah. Yes. Hi, buddy. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so glad we finally get to do a podcast again.
Yay! It's been a while.
Yes, too long.
It has been a while.
Gotta kick that guy out of here.
I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Make him go do work.
Yeah.
Loser. Slacker. All right. Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I just, we get him out of here and we'll just bring
him
in.
It's kind of nice just to get the ladies.
I know.
You know.
Yeah, and today we actually, I noticed that we have two of us, ladies, and we are talking to two ladies.
So we
spoke to Gloria Ekpo, the Senior Technical Advisor, HIV and AIDS Health International Programs Group, and she's with World Vision.
Mm-hmm.
So she talked to us about World Vision and what they're doing in their community as far as AIDS relief. And then we spoke with Neela Somaya, who is a Mental Health Activities Manager with Doctors Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to say it. Medicine Sans Frontières.
I'm going to go with that, and I'm just going to say MSF.
Yes, MSF is the acronym.
Sounded good though. I wish you had more of a thicker accent.
Yeah. See, I only have a few words that I can say in French, and they are food related mostly. Of course, I mean everybody knows what an omelette is, right? Or a quiche. But like the only French phrase that I've got in my lexicon is le singe est sur la table. And that's probably terrible as well.
All the French people that listen to this podcast are just laughing at you.
The monkey is on the table. Fact.
All right, man.
That's all that means. So,
I like it.
Yeah, that's what I've got. But, if you hear Neela refer to MSF in the podcast, which she does, she is referring to the French acronym for Doctors Without Borders.
Correct.
So... it is good times. But yeah, we talked about World AIDS Day, which occurred on December 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a holiday that has been happening since the 1980s.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really when people were being made aware of HIV AIDS.
Yeah, when people really started getting sick and people didn't know what it was. And then when it was discovered, okay, this is an autoimmune disease. What do we do? Mm-hmm. How do we confront this? And it was declared an epidemic in the 80s.
And it's still an ongoing prevalent issue today.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll definitely talk about some stats in a minute, but I wanted to hit you up.
Hit
question
me
Question of the podcast.
Okay.
So World AIDS Day, December 1st.
Mm-hmm.
What thing or event do you wish There was a day. Like, it had its
two-part
own
day.
Two-part day. Okay.
First part, obviously, I just think, I'm a little political here, but I do think that the day to vote should be a national holiday.
Okay.
We should get it off.
Okay.
Just throwing that out there.
Right.
My second one is, throwing this out, it's a little weird.
Okay.
But I think that we should have Middle School Appreciation Day for all the awkward times that you had to go through.
So, okay, like, the voting thing is pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Like, what you're doing.
Yeah.
For Washington, it's not like, hey, we need so much.
Yeah.
It would be nice if there was a national holiday.
But I think it should be a national holiday.
Yeah, if you're going to have to wait in line for 5 hours to vote,
right,
you're
it's
not going
not
to
not even just poll sites, but to bring national recognition to the importance of your vote.
And voting, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I have no statistics on this, but I do believe that if you had the day off, because think about how many people wait to turn in their mail-in ballot.
Oh, yeah, till the end
day
of the
day.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I got to do that. Oh, I got to do that. So
I'm a super procrastinator
weeks,
with it. Absolutely,
there you go.
Yeah.
And so if you at least have the day off, you get it in at 9.
Yeah.
You know.
It'd be there.
It'd be there before your deadline.
Okay,
at 8
so then the middle school appreciation day, what would you like to see happening there?
Just to one, bring awareness that middle school was awkward for everyone.
Okay.
Two, the current middle schoolers to be like, hey, it's okay that you're weird.
Yeah.
Or it's okay that you don't know everything that's going on. I didn't want to say high school because lost cause. No, I'm just kidding. No, but like I think in middle school you have this opportunity, like you're like just absorbing a lot more information. You haven't like really joined your clique yet,
okay.
I guess you could say. And I think that you're open to participating in programs and band and choir or maybe things that like in high school aren't perceived as cool.
Sure. So on Middle School Appreciation Day, if there were like things for kids to do that were nerdy or fun.
Yeah, or sporty or
sporty.
Whatever. You know, I think that like there's a lot of options. You can get to math club.
Go outside
AV
of your
club.
Normal box.
Yeah.
If you're a math kid, then why don't you try drama instead?
Yeah. You know, I just think that there's lots of
that
options.
One day.
And then as an adult, you can be supportive of those individuals that maybe, you know, are, you know, reclusive.
Sure.
You know, they want, like, be like, hey, I was weird.
Yeah.
I did this, and now look at me now kind of thing. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. What about you?
Well, I mean, I was looking at how there are all kinds of holidays and all kinds of days. Like, there's bizarro days. You
peanut
know?
Butter day.
Exactly. There's
no
peanut butter
day.
There's chocolate and peanut butter day. There's, like, ice cream day.
Mm-hmm.
There's,
mm-hmm.
you know, vegetarian day, vegan day. Like, there's all kinds of
Speaking
days.
Speaking as the vegan and vegetarian in our office.
Sure. But, like, there's all kinds of days. But then I was like, you know what? I just want someone to give me a day. Just
oh,
give me a
is
day.
Is that your birthday?
Whatever. Just worship me and do everything that I need
oh,
to be done
yeah.
on this day.
Wow.
That's what I want.
I mean...
Is that too much to ask for?
I mean, you have a birthday.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So do you want, like, another day? Like, your six-month
yeah, why not?
Birthday?
Yeah, like, six-month
what
anniversary?
What would people have to do for you?
My six-month birthday, I think, would be Valentine's Day.
Oh,
yeah, it'd be Valentine's
look
Day.
At you. Cutie.
So, love me extra double on Valentine's
okay,
Day. Please.
Okay, okay.
Please do that for me.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
All right, we can do that.
All right, great.
Cool.
So, if you want to tell us about whatever kind of day, you can hit us up at WastateCFD, Jerrica's favorite thing ever.
Or use the hashtag Washington Gibbs.
Yeah. Hashtag Washington Gibbs.
Yeah.
So, on to our interviews.
Yes.
This is our interview with Gloria Ekpo. Senior Technical Advisor, HIV and AIDS Health International Programs Group. She's with World Vision, so we'll kick it over to Gloria. Okay, so we're here with Gloria Ekpo, the Senior Technical Advisor, HIV and AIDS Health International Programs Group with World Vision. Gloria, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today.
So we just want to know if you can give us a little history about World Vision and what your organization does for the community.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think early back in the 1950, one man, Robert Pierce, helped a little girl with $5 in his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how World Vision started. And even over the years, through his efforts, he has been able to mobilize a lot of church leaders to be able to tackle the issues of HIV and AIDS at that time, which was not really very common for people to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy that 65 years thereafter, World Vision is still here as a Christian humanitarian organization dedicated to ensure that children, families, and their communities her full potential in life by tackling the root causes of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it started. And over the years, our development work has spanned over to health, HIV, nutrition, child protection, education, water sanitation, humanitarian emergencies, economic development, and advocacy work. And we've been able to reach almost 100 million people.
Wow.
Nice. In 100 countries, and the work continues. And what we really do, we've been able to empower people to come out of poverty,
mm-hmm.
and our services is irrespective of your age, your religion, or gender, or mm-hmm. race. And we just hope that children and their families will be able to fulfill their potential in life. So that's basically what we do, and mm-hmm. we work with the grassroots, the faith leaders, the community workers, and our staff. We have about 46,000 staff,
okay.
95% of mm-hmm. them which are locals at their mm-hmm. various national mm-hmm. offices.
Right.
So that's what we do, and we hope to continue to do that with your support.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Yeah. So kind of talking a little bit directly about World AIDS Day, can you kind of talk really what World Vision does for the fight to prevent HIV and AIDS, and how you kind of work with those partners directly?
Thank you very much. At the beginning of the HIV epidemic, we were caught in the middle because parents were dying and the children were left behind, no one to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had developed a tool called Channels of Hope.
Mm-hmm.
To engage the community, to engage parents, the government, every stakeholder, to be able to support the orphans and vulnerable children with all the basic necessities of life,
mm-hmm.
shelter, food, clothing, be
yeah.
able to access health care and education. And over the time, that has grown, not just for the orphans. We work with adolescents, we work with at workplaces,
mm-hmm.
whatever vulnerabilities we see in communities, we tackle those. And so in commemoration of the World AIDS Day, everything around our HIV programming is around compassionate care.
Okay.
So through that model, we've been able to sensitize a lot of communities, faith leaders, church leaders,
mm-hmm.
community workers to provide psychosocial support,
yeah.
help support children stay in school, help
yeah.
reduce their risk to HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So we provide school supplies, we link them to health services, we empower them, economic empowerment for their caregivers,
mm-hmm.
and also psychosocial support, care for depression and other
mm-hmm.
work. And it has also expanded to workplaces because we're working with hard-to-reach population, vulnerable population,
right.
that are far away from health facilities. So we try to extend services to their HIV testing,
mm-hmm.
linking them to care and treatment, mm-hmm. and supporting them to retaining care.
So does World Vision set up these sites for HIV and AIDS to get tested, or do you work with those faith-based partners for those sites? How does that work?
We do both.
Okay.
In some programs, especially if we have a large grant,
mm-hmm.
that allows us to work directly with the health facilities. So we provide the testing, train
mm-hmm.
healthcare workers to do
oh,
the
wow.
testing, and we refer people to testing.
That's wonderful.
And where we do not have the health facilities in our general World Vision work, we create demand, we mobilize people, go get tested.
Mm-hmm.
We support, work with them to the health facilities
okay.
to get tested. And of recent, we are even using the churches, worship centers to help do the testing. I know they talk about it, they preach it on
mm-hmm.
Sundays, but this is more proactive.
Mm-hmm.
We
Definitely.
Do self-testing at those facilities and then link them to health facilities
okay.
for additional testing and care and treatment depending on their status.
Okay.
So we do both.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's amazing. So, of course, HIV and AIDS became well known in the 80s and the 90s, but I don't think that it's talked about too much nowadays as far as like a general kind of discussion. Do you feel like HIV and AIDS are talked about enough today?
That's a very important question. I don't think it's talked a lot today.
Yeah.
In the 80s, when the epidemic was really much, even in this country,
mm-hmm.
it was well talked about, and grants and programs were set in place to ensure that people have access to care.
Yeah.
And about 15 years ago, through the benevolence of the American people, the PEPFAR program, President's Emergency Relief, or AIDS Relief, was able to channel funding to developing countries where the epidemic was hit, to be able to provide access to care and treatment, and lots of progress has made since then. So after the initial mobilization and effort, and seeing the importance of being in treatment and having improved quality of life, people have not talked much about it, they've not done much about it, and funding is towards decreasing. So we are looking at epidemic control, the US government as well as the United Nations AIDS program are looking at the fast track 90% to ensure that you know, people know their status, and those who know are linked to care and are staying retained in care with viral suppression. So we are re-engaging the communities, the faith-based, the everybody that has, who is affected or infected with HIV, to say, let's reach the last mile of controlling the epidemic. So much still needs to be done to really cope the epidemic.
Absolutely.
Part of World Vision, you guys have a program called Dreams, that kind of that keeps girls in school safer from AIDS. And then, if they weren't in this type of program, does the youth have a more difficult time, or do you think that there would be more outbreak if these girls weren't in Dreams? And then, could you talk a little bit about what Dreams is?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our belief is that no adolescent girl or no adolescent boy or girl should be left behind. So much of our programs have tailored towards that. DREAMS is an acronym for Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored, and Safe. Just building resilience of adolescent girls to stay free of HIV and AIDS. Even at the foundational work for orphans and vulnerable care, we provided HIV education, we provided life skills, but we found out that there was gap. After that knowledge base, what next? And addressing household economic empowerment and resilience contributed to some of the girls doing having risky behaviors because they wanted to leave, and rightly so too. So they had to engage in risky behavior. But what the DREAMS program now does is it provides a more systematic, comprehensive care for adolescent girls and young women to ensure that, one, they receive the information they need, they stay in school, and they have the skills to make them resilient, to say no to risky life behavior when they do not really want to engage in that. Not just that, we also work to empower their partners to have the same information, get access to essential HIV and AIDS prevention methods that are available, evidence-based methods. So that is how we are doing, and we have this program in several of the countries that are implementing it.
So it's really
a lot of results.
A grassroots. It's really at the local level is where you guys begin, really, because you're working so close within a community to help these kids really get that education.
It's at the grassroots.
Yeah.
And we use structures at the community. It could be a school space. It could be community space. And you know, at the community, they have town halls where meetings are held. So these safe space for girls, or we call them girls club or safe spaces, whatever it's called, where we mobilize about 12, each club has about 12 to 20 girls.
That's amazing.
Where they come in, share resilience strategies, share updated information on HIV and AIDS, share life skills, and a lot of them have been able to be empowered. And even in one of our countries, it was so interesting. The adolescent girls club was so successful because we recruited even those before the adolescent age, the sisters of those girls,
that's smart,
to be part of it, just to prevent them from being exposed like their senior sisters were. And the interesting thing was that the boys themselves, the friends to the girls in the program were a bit curious. What are you teaching or doing to our girls? We want to know. And we didn't want other young boys to also put them at risk or poach them. So that made us to also deliver a dream-like program for the young boys, where we empower them, address the issues of gender-based violence, stigma, discrimination, so that together they support the dream girls to achieve their potential. So that has been very helpful. And most of them also have a life skills saving groups where they contribute money, use that to meet their various needs. So it's been very interesting.
That's
very
nice. Cool.
Thank you. So you spoke about education, and you spoke about World Vision staff taking people to actual locations to help them get care and tested. Are there other tools that you've seen that are successful in preventing HIV and AIDS, or tools that you guys use that are working?
Yes, there are a lot of tools that help, a lot of evidence-based ones, like one of those ones I talked about, channels of hope to address stigma, discrimination, and gender-based violence. We've also adopted that to include child protection and maternal and child health, so that it helps mothers who are pregnant and are HIV positive to be linked to care, as well as their children. The other tool we also use in our program is called Stepping Stones methodology, whereby in each of the communities, we engage them in their various groups, the adolescent girls, the women, and the men, and address the key issues of the community that that affects, relates to HIV and AIDS, so that within the community, though in different settings, concurrently they are learning things that will help improve and reduce risk to HIV AIDS in the community, not just to HIV AIDS, but gender-based violence, addressing harmful traditional norms that are preventing girls from achieving their potentials in life. And another tool that we find very helpful too is what we call Citizens' Voice and Action. It's a social accountability tool whereby the citizens, the community people, are aware of their rights, that the government said, okay, this population should have access to at least one health facility and one nurse, or should have access to education or this X amenities. And where it's not there, the citizens are educated to, one, find what's available for them, engage with their local legislative officers, and show evidence that what they are supposed to have, they don't have, and they have a scorecard to see how they improve. So that has really improved the engagement of the citizens with their local governing body to improve access to care to them. So those are some of the few we are using to mobilize and work at the grassroots to be able to improve access to healthcare and services.
Have you found that there are populations that don't have immediate access to a health facility that have to go further and further away to get care?
Yes, and that is very common in most of the rural settings. At most national levels, healthcare is concentrated more at the urban areas, overpopulated areas. But in some settings, people have to walk several kilometers to be able to access healthcare, and that, of course, is a deterrent. Like if you have a mother that has a child, she needs family planning services, the child needs immunization, or they need to be treated, and she walks several kilometers to go access care. Or a pregnant woman not being able to get to the health facility in time for labor. You know, those are quite challenges. So with their domestic work and all their needs, it's difficult. They have to weigh in a lot. Traveling that far, sometimes transportation costs will be a challenge. And then leaving all your domestic work to go line up in a clinic, and you may not be done till the end of the day, and then walk back home and still continue with your domestic work, is a challenge. That's why in our programs, we try as much as possible to bring the services closer to them through mobile health clinics, mobile testing services, and we are also advancing those services to church centers in the sense that the nearest health facilities works with the closest church facility center to be able to run mobile health clinics, you know, so that instead of walking all that way, they could weigh their children, check their weight, receive information, get tested, or get additional information, and in order to be seen at the health facility.
It's really a whole, like a wholesome thing that you guys do as World Vision is, even though you help in certain different areas, it's really the whole person or the whole woman or man that you're really assisting in the family unit.
Exactly. Yeah. And that integrated approach is really what is sustainable, mm-hmm. because this child may have malaria and pneumonia, and you can't send the child to physician for pneumonia, mm-hmm. physician for malaria, mm-hmm. or the mother family planning and she needs HIV testing. So we try in our program as much as possible to have this one-stop care.
Yeah.
She comes in, we access within reasonable time her needs and address it same day, mm-hmm. With those of our child. And even in HIV treatment facilities, we're encouraging same-day treatment.
Yeah.
If you come and get tested and they examine you and you're okay to start the antiretroviral therapy, you get started. And when you return to the community, volunteers within the community support and follow you up to make sure that you stay in care.
Oh, wow. You know,
so that integrated, yeah. comprehensive work, mm-hmm. is really very, very important.
Yeah. It really gets the community involved in helping each other.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's
true. Do people who are like volunteers, do they stay with certain patients in their community, or do they like they shadow them, or
they do not really stay with one person?
Mm-hmm.
What we do, we try to prevent duplication of efforts.
Sure.
Mm. Or reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
Most governments have at the grassroots level what they call community volunteers, mm-hmm. some call it health surveillance officers. They are not really in the paid structure of the government, but they are mobilized, mm-hmm. to do immunization services or, mm-hmm. to do whatever health projects the, mm-hmm. government wants to do. So these are the core people available on the ground that we often tap into,
okay.
to improve their skills in training, to help them mobilize for whatever we want to do, equip them with promotional material so that they represent us whenever they go.
Mm-hmm.
So they are more or less there.
Yeah.
And few of them, like when human resources for health really became depleted on, mm-hmm. account of the HIV epidemic, grandmothers, retired teachers, retired nurses came back into the pool of these, mm. volunteers to be able to support, okay. the scale up of the work. So they bring their skills to help with the work. And what we do is we normally do not pay them. We only provide the training, the mobilization,
mm-hmm.
or maybe if your transport costs, we reimburse your transport costs, or your airtime calling and following up people.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to avoid monetary incentives as much as possible,
sure.
because it's not sustainable, mm-hmm. and the government may not be able to pick up. But most of the volunteers find that they have value add to the community. They are more respected because they are now serving not just themselves, but other people in the community. And most times the promotional materials, either the t-shirt or the cap or the bag or the kit, brings additional recognition,
mm,
to them.
Mm.
And in some countries, we're trying to see some of them with additional skills, are there ways they could be reabsorbed into the government system,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
so we work hand in hand with the Ministry of Health or social structure to ensure that some of those are done. But most of them are just happy doing what they're doing,
yeah.
in order to improve the quality of life for those they serve. Yeah,
right.
That's incredible. I'm going to kind of change topics a little bit. I do have a question directly for you. Is what, actually, how did you get involved in World Vision? We didn't ask you that earlier.
Yeah, that's a very good question. My background, I'm a physician in obstetrics and gynecology.
Okay.
And I've done a clinical practice for about 20 years before I came into public health practice the last 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen firsthand the devastation of HIV and AIDS,
mm-hmm.
and what poverty has done at the grassroots level. So that initial time when there was no HIV and AIDS medicine, I just see pregnant women die without, even when they get tested, there were no medication.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you tell the husbands to get tested, they said, why should I test when there's nothing for me? And I'm very happy things have evolved over the years now that we have things to test mothers and children, and then they're able to stay alive, and a lot of progress. So I'm happy about,
yeah.
that. And why I came to World Vision following my clinical practice, I discovered I needed to boost my skills in epidemiology mm-hmm. and biostatistics. So I came to Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and mm-hmm. I did my master's in public health there. Right. So thereafter, I just said, instead of staying clinically one-to-one mm-hmm. yeah. and begin to argue or ask a client mm-hmm. or a patient, why didn't you come? Mm-hmm. Why did you do this? Why didn't you take this medication? Yeah. My exposure to public health made me understand the social determinants of health oh. that enables that woman to come to my clinic yeah. or obey or comply to whatever I had written.
Yeah.
And that gave me a better perspective and understanding. Yeah. Yeah. And also have passion working with vulnerable communities. Mm-hmm. I also came from a vulnerable community myself mm-hmm. because at that time, girls' education was not entertained, mm-hmm. you know. So I pleaded with my father to send me to school, mm-hmm. and I was the first girl that went to school. I was the first girl in my community to be a doctor. So that opened doors, you know, to many other children and girls mm-hmm. to be educated and achieve their dreams. So I've worked in other secular organizations, and when I came to World Vision, I discovered that my passion and professional goals merge. Oh. They work with the vulnerable people, they work with the grassroots to improve quality of life,
yeah.
and they provided integrated care, and they go extra mile to help. And I felt that's where I should be, and I've been there for 10 years now.
Oh, nice.
That's incredible.
I'm still there, so yeah. that is why I'm here.
Right mm-hmm. on.
Thank you. I just wanted to know.
Thank you.
So let's say somebody hears this podcast and they want to begin giving to World Vision. Can you talk a little bit about what donations do for your organization?
I'm still working for World Vision because of the donation we receive from people. And we have several outlets for donation.
Uh-huh.
And we appreciate that being continued. One of the areas of volunteering or serving in World Vision is being a child sponsor.
Mm.
You know, that costs about $30 a month.
Okay.
And yeah. with that, what that gives is we are able to regularly monitor the child. We are able to prevent abuse and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
We link them to health services, to education that they mm-hmm. need. And we use them funds to support the community structures that help the
yeah.
child. They may need water or school,
mm-hmm.
School built, or support the healthcare staff. They may be able to
yeah.
work with them. And as a sponsor, you also receive regular updates on the progress of the child. The child sends you a letter, you can respond
mm-hmm.
to them. You can give additional gifts, and you also have opportunity to also visit them,
mm-hmm.
you know, coordinating with the country of choice.
That's
the cool. other areas of volunteering, which we find very useful to also, is running a race. Like sometimes volunteers, we work with volunteers to run a race, maybe 1 mile, 2 miles,
mm-hmm.
just to mobilize
mm-hmm.
response to support
mm-hmm.
a particular cause.
Mm-hmm.
We also work with volunteers to build what we call kits. It could be healthcare kits, like
mm-hmm.
those people providing healthcare for people living with HIV and
mm-hmm.
AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
The health kit will contain antiseptics,
yeah.
gloves, and things like that, or hygiene kits for children, or education
mm-hmm.
kits, school bags. So we have a ability to support each school or each community or each church or each organization to package as many
yeah,
gifts,
yeah.
build such kits for the children as much as possible. We encourage people to also, if you are passionate about something, you can create an online funding,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereby you can request your friends, you know, to, oh, I saw this, like, for example, I have a gift catalog here. One duck cost.
Oh, yeah, okay.
One duck cost $10,
cute.
You know.
Yeah.
A one chicken like this goes for about maybe
$25. Yeah.
Just to give household ability to be able to come out of poverty by eating
yeah.
the produce from those donations and getting the nourishment they need. We also, definitely we need prayer. There are a lot of campaigns to end violence, to end hunger, and we encourage people to go to worldvision.org and see those campaigns and be part of it. So that's how people volunteer to support us. A lot of donation, corporate donations, and sometimes we have gifts in kind, like school materials or school supplies to be able to help communities come out of poverty. So there are various ways, and depending on your passion and interest, it's good to log in and see where you can pitch in.
Very nice. Thank you. The last question I have for you is, do you have any upcoming events or programs you'd like to highlight?
Yes, I think as part of our sharing our experiences, we use whatever venue and opportunities we have to do that. For the World AIDS Day, in promotion of adolescent health working children, we are holding Dreams event, which will be December 11th. It's in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wonderful.
You know, we are bringing in key players to show how we have worked with adolescents to help 99% of them stay in school and be HIV free, how we've done it, addressing gender-based violence, and even so interesting, even in incorporating menstrual hygiene management, in which even the boys help the girls do that. So the life skill and empowerment, we want to show our results in doing that. So we encourage people to support and be a part of that. In addition, I think at our various country level, we also organize local activities to support that. Webinars, online webinars to share what we're doing.
Yeah.
So, and those are all within our, at our website. So.
Excellent.
Right
thank,
on.
Thank you, Gloria. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about World Vision and what you guys do.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, that was our interview with Gloria Ekpo from World Vision.
She's great.
She was great. I loved her. Now we're going to go on to our interview with Neela Somaya. She is a mental health activities manager with Doctors Without Borders. Here's Neela. All right, so we are here with Neela Somaya, the mental health activities manager for Doctors Without Borders. And how would you pronounce it in French?
Médecins Sans Frontières.
Very
but I
nice.
Have to say that's probably not a perfect French. So my apologies to all the Francophone listeners.
Well, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me here.
So can you give us a little history about Doctors Without Borders and what your organization does for the community?
Yes. So Doctors Without Borders is an international medical humanitarian organization. And what we do is we provide emergency aid to people who are affected by armed conflict, epidemics, natural disasters, or sometimes it's just simply people who don't have access to medical care.
Okay.
The organization is quite well known, I think, for its emergency projects, but we also do have longer term projects, and the HIV projects is an example of that, but we can talk about that a little bit more. The actual organization was founded in 1971 by a group of small doctors and journalists. They had just been involved with the war and the famine in Biafra, Nigeria.
Okay.
And just, I think, seeing the destruction and all that sort of stuff happening there, this group decided to start Doctors Without Borders. And so that was in 1971. And since then, we've grown quite a bit. We work in over 70 countries right now, and we have about 42,000 people on staff.
Wow.
Yeah, quite large.
Yeah,
so,
but needed.
Exactly. So the staff are medical personnel, they're logisticians, admin staff, and the staff also includes expats like myself, somebody going to another country to work. Or and it also includes national staff, so people in the country that we're working in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell a little bit about how you actually got involved in Doctors Without Borders or MSF?
Yeah. So I didn't grow up in North America. I actually grew up in Kenya, and my parents were in the medical field, and so I grew up seeing my parents do things, you know, outside of their jobs. And so I always thought some kind of humanitarian, I always thought I wanted to get into some kind of humanitarian work. And so I picked MSF, Doctors Without Borders, in particular, because I liked their working principles. And I was actually going to mention something about this, you know, because all our actions are based, of course, on medical ethics, but on the principles of independence, impartiality, and neutrality.
Yeah.
And that's what really attracted me to Doctors Without Borders, because these principles basically govern all our actions.
Mm-hmm.
Our independence is rooted in our funding.
Mm-hmm.
90% of our funding comes from private citizens.
Wow.
A little bit from corporations,
mm-hmm.
no governments.
Wow.
And so this now allows us to be independent.
Yeah.
So we can provide aid to wherever the need is the greatest,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And to everybody, regardless of ethnicity, race,
mm-hmm.
gender,
mm-hmm.
Political
right.
affiliation.
Right.
And so that's what attracted me to MSF,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, medical aid, medical treatment is a right for everybody.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We all need it.
Yes.
Exactly. And so that's why I chose to, you know, apply to
mm-hmm.
Doctors Without Borders. And
yeah.
so now here I am.
Hey, congrats on the job.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Thank you.
And how long have you been with them?
So I joined them in 2013.
Okay.
I've done 4 projects with
mm-hmm.
them so far.
Mm-hmm.
One in South Sudan,
okay.
one in Papua New Guinea,
yeah.
and 2 in Myanmar.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they've ranged from a couple of months to about
yeah.
1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is your role what is your role in those areas
in
with these projects?
Yeah. So I'm the mental health activities
mm-hmm.
manager. And so my role is mainly managing the actual mental health program within the project.
Okay.
It involves consulting with the counseling team, which is usually made up of national staff.
Mm-hmm.
So they're lay counselors. So MSF trains them.
Yeah.
And we you know, so my role is basically, you know, continuing training, giving up, helping them, you know, increase their skills, but also consulting
mm-hmm.
on cases with our patients. You know, the idea is really to empower them, because
yeah.
you know, in some places we can't stay forever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can leave, you know,
right.
skilled people behind, that's good.
They
right?
can continue
yeah.
on
yeah.
in the community.
It's sustainable,
yeah.
and it can yeah, exactly.
Right. So sometimes I do see the patients directly
mm-hmm.
with the counselors. Sometimes it's on a co-consulting basis.
Mm-hmm.
In South Sudan, I did do the counseling directly with a translator. That's because it was an emergency mission, and we didn't have any lay counselors
mm-hmm.
trained
mm-hmm.
at that point. So,
mm-hmm.
so, but it is mainly supporting our national staff counseling
yeah.
teams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as far as HIV and AIDS,
mm-hmm.
what kind of efforts does your organization have to like fight or prevent HIV
okay.
and AIDS?
Yeah. So I'm really actually quite proud of our HIV programs. I my last project in Myanmar for a year was in an HIV project.
Okay.
And so I can tell you a little bit, you know, I'll name some of, start off maybe naming some of the services. Well, of course, the first one is that we provide antiretroviral treatment.
Okay.
And so that, you know, I think, as we know, you know, HIV AIDS, there's no cure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But antiretroviral medication helps maybe sometimes slow down the disease, helps somebody's life to be
okay.
prolonged.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the major you know, one of our major services is
mm-hmm.
to provide this antiretroviral medication.
Mm-hmm.
We also do health education and awareness activities, condom prevention. We do HIV testing, of
mm-hmm.
course, and counseling. Another important service that we have is prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
Okay.
And basically that entails giving, you know, antiretrovirals to the mom during pregnancy, labor, and breastfeeding, and then also to the baby when the infant is born. So that's a big important
yeah.
part. And then we also provide treatment for what is called opportunistic infections.
Okay.
So like TB. So for example,
yeah.
So you know, HIV
weakens your immune system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're susceptible to all sorts of things.
Right.
Yeah.
And TB happens to be a very, very common.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and hepatitis C as well, oh. Right? So they're very, and you know, they're nasty diseases,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So as Doctors Without Borders, we also provide treatment for that. And in fact, you know, a really a disturbing stat to me is that, you know, TB is one of the biggest killers of people living with HIV. And that nearly 400,000 people die each year of TB related, you know, that someone with AIDS is HIV.
It's like you're battling more than the HIV AIDS yourself. Like,
that's right.
You know, it's...
That's right.
It's like getting more sick when you're already sick.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
And I think, you know, for me as working in this last project in Myanmar, you know, to see having to deal with HIV is hard enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have medication every day. You know, you have to be really vigilant in your regime,
mm-hmm.
your scheduling, right? But then you throw in TB or you throw in Hep C.
Yeah.
You know, you're adding another handful of pills.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you throw in other issues like poverty, displacement, substance use.
Yeah.
It becomes really difficult. It
Absolutely.
Really becomes difficult for people to stay on their medication regimes, right?
Is that something that Doctors Without Borders helps assist in, or do you guys, how does that process work? So, you know, you're providing that medicine.
That's right.
Then what's the step that you guys do from there?
This is where the mental health team comes. This is where the counselors come in.
Mm-hmm.
We have adherence counseling teams, and so this is where they come in. So you know, they provide support for the person right away from the beginning. So
okay.
it's sort of from the beginning of testing. So they do pre-testing counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the diagnosis comes, you know, if it's negative, great. But then they'll talk about prevention.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's positive, they help the person come to sort of terms with the diagnosis and what this means. And then they're working with the patient the whole way through in terms of... you know, the challenges that they're coming up with, you know,
mm-hmm.
because adherence, you know, staying on your medication is the key, right? And unfortunately, if somebody also contracts TB, like we just said, you know, another handful of pills, some of the side effects of the TB medications are really awful.
Yeah.
Depression and psychosis.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So mental health counseling very important.
Exactly.
You're just tripling.
Yeah. So Doctors Without Borders, we're doing the medical, you know, but then we might sometimes have to do the psychiatric medications too, right?
Sure. So you mentioned transmission between pregnant mothers to infants.
Right.
Now, I don't know much about this, but it always seemed to me that, like, if you're a mother and you are infected with HIV or AIDS, there's no way that your baby's not going to get that disease. So babies are being born without HIV and AIDS to women who have the disease.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, like, how does that work exactly? How does a woman not transmit that disease to her baby?
And so I may not be able to answer it completely,
because
that's not medical.
Sure.
But basically the theory behind it is that, you know, with antiretrovirals, you know, the ideal is to get your viral load in your blood as low as possible to non-detectable.
Okay.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
And so then it's harder
to transmit. Okay.
To transmit. So when a woman becomes pregnant and she's HIV positive, there are these special regimes, these antiviral regimes that she'll go on during the pregnancy and during... you know, labor to try and prevent
the transmission.
Thinking about this, and now that's kind of where my mind went, but it, let's say the child is born with HIV, what is the youngest that you've seen that you've had to give them start? I mean, what happens? I mean, does the child start having to take how does that work?
It depends on the child. So the child, you know, after the child is born, they're tested, and if they are, you know, there's a series of tests that the children get, you know, before they're officially declared positive or negative. And then, you know, it determines, you know, there's guidelines, there's HIV guidelines in terms of, you know, regular testing of the children and when, it, after viral load reaching a certain level, then they would start antiretrovirals.
Okay. I was just curious because I was like, I just didn't know.
No. Fair enough.
I think in a way, like, that's part of World AIDS Day is just bringing more awareness
to a lot of
questions that just are unaware of.
And you know, the prevention schedule, it's I wish I had the statistics. I don't. I mean, I could always send it to you later.
Yes, absolutely.
I can.
Yes.
I can certainly do that, you know, in terms of the effectiveness. But, you know, if the mother is able to stay on her medication regime, and it's a very, very high success rate that the baby will be negative.
Very nice.
And then after the baby's born, like I said. Yeah. And so, personally, the youngest I've seen on antiretrovirals in Myanmar was 3 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
HIV and AIDS, it's really prevalent in, like, sub-Saharan Africa, as far as, like, the world is.
Yeah.
And I saw a stat on your website that said that some people are unaware that they're affected.
Right.
And it kind of seemed that the prevalence compared to how many people are really aware of it was kind of opposite. Like, people just don't know that they have HIV or AIDS, but it's a really high rate in sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So have you seen any kind of clear indications as to why people wouldn't know they're infected with HIV or AIDS?
Which stat did you see? Was it
It was something like 16% of people thought that they were infected when they were actually, it was a higher. Yeah, there was a higher rate of infection.
Right.
Yeah.
I think one of the causes one of the things that Doctors Without Borders is concerned about right now is that, you know, some international funding has been cut.
Okay.
Right.
And I think because we've made so many advances in the actual treatment, I think, you know, I'm hoping that we don't become more complacent.
Sure.
Then
right.
I focus on,
yeah.
you know, and so I'm wondering if it's just it's awareness. People just don't have access to going and being tested. You know, so for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, I know that, a lot of them are low-income countries, right? And so they depend heavily on international funding, right? And so, if they don't have the services for awareness and pre-testing, for testing, then people are not going to know.
Yeah.
But I do have a stat here that says that, 30-40% of people starting HIV treatment today already have advanced HIV disease.
Oh, wow.
Towards
gosh.
The end of AIDS, to the continuum of AIDS, right? And that what we're seeing in sub-Saharan Africa, in our Doctors Without Borders supported hospitals, is that, these people who are coming, 25-30% of them are dying within 48 hours of arrival.
Wow.
So this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is, it's our concern, I think. It's like, we can't take away funding from...
Mm-hmm.
prevention, from testing.
Yeah.
And awareness, right?
Right. Yeah.
What, for your guys, for Doctors Without Borders' mission,
right?
Are you the one setting up those testing sites? Are you working with partners within that community to have that, pamphlets and awareness and that educational piece, before you guys come in or during the time that you come in? How does that process work?
Yeah.
So then when you come in, people are aware to come to you and with open arms,
In all of our these types of projects, we're in partnership with the government, the Ministry of Health.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, because, we can't
just show up.
And start a brand new hospital, And so, for example, in Myanmar, we worked very closely with... the Ministry of Health in Myanmar, and so basically we were working in their hospitals and their clinics, right?
Yeah.
We did have a couple separate clinics, but we're always working in conjunction because you don't want to offend anybody and just
step on the government's toes.
So exactly.
Yeah.
And it's important, in terms of sustainability, right?
Yeah.
Since you have seen, so you've been to all these different projects that you've worked on. So all the different regions that you've served, what kind of the stigmas have you actually seen with those living with HIV or AIDS?
So my last mission was the main HIV project that I worked with. Stigma is a really awful. It's really a big problem, I think, in a lot of these countries. Because
I think it is here.
And then that also, yeah, exactly. And I think that also prevents people from being tested, maybe,
sure.
Right? You know, I'm just thinking of one client as you said that one patient in Myanmar. It was really, really difficult. She was born with HIV because mm-hmm. her parents had. She was now a teenager. Her parents had now, you know, were now deceased from AIDS, and so she was living with her extended family, grandparents,
sure.
aunts, and uncles. And the stigma was so bad in that family that she was actually just she was isolated. She had her own room.
Mm-hmm.
They had separate utensils for her.
Oh wow!
They had separate water glasses mm-hmm. for her. And it was really difficult to work with this family because no amount of education,
right.
you know, I don't know if there was a cultural thing there, but no amount of education would budge them in saying
yeah.
that, you know, you're not going to get HIV
yeah.
by sharing, sitting on
yeah.
the, at the table with her,
yeah.
right? And she would have to come to the clinic on her own. She was 15.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Do you see that
so,
a lot?
Stigma is awful. Yeah, I think in with some, yes, we do. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think it's still there.
Really prevalent
I think it's
today,
still there,
it
and I think we do need to have a lot
yeah.
more awareness about
yeah.
it. You know, luckily for this teen, I mean, you know, trying to look at something positive in it, you know, she had us. She
yeah,
had
right.
the counselors.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was very, very close with one of the counselors who spoke the same kind of same language as she did, with different tribal language, and so, so at least you know she was not totally alone.
Sure.
And so, and that's why the mental health part and the counseling
yeah.
psychosocial
right.
Component is so important.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, in your experience, what kind of things have you seen people can do to prevent HIV or AIDS infections?
You mean
Doctors Without Borders? Like, what have you guys seen that's successful to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS?
I think we do a lot of awareness activities
okay.
and prevention activities. And so, you know, for example, this World AIDS Day
mm-hmm.
that just passed, each project usually does their own little activity in each
okay.
country. And so I they will, you know, put up a booth in the park or something
mm-hmm.
like that, and then they will talk about prevention, and they'll talk about, you know, whatever, you know,
yeah.
condom, you know,
mm-hmm.
needles, whatever, you know,
yeah.
mm-hmm.
the basics of
yeah.
how to protect yourself
yeah.
from, you know, safe sex, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so we do those kind of awareness activities.
Right.
Okay.
Within a community.
Okay.
And then also working with, you know, Ministry of Health, mm-hmm. with the government, you know,
mm-hmm.
in partnership
mm-hmm.
with them, we can do something
yeah.
with that as well.
What is something that people should know about Doctors Without Borders in relation that maybe we haven't asked you in regards to HIV/AIDS?
Mm-hmm.
What's something that you think that, you know, we haven't asked you today that you think that people didn't know about or be aware about that, you know.
Well, I you know, for me, I think it is that we can't run without we you know, we can't run our programs, and we can't do anything what we do without support from the public.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And you know, we're very appreciative of people.
Mm-hmm.
The people who already give to us,
mm-hmm.
but in specific in HIV, for example, so you know, donation, you know, medication is expensive, running hospitals
mm-hmm.
is expensive,
yeah.
buying equipment is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So with HIV, the antiretrovirals, the first line drugs cost $80 per person,
okay,
per year,
okay,
and so. You know, we make use of every dollar we get.
Yeah,
that, well, I guess
yeah.
what I'm trying to say
yeah.
is that you know, what I want people to know is that every dollar that they give us is
mm-hmm.
put to good use.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you give $10, great. That goes towards the $80.
Yeah, right. No, yeah.
If you give $80, that's great, mm-hmm. because you know that's antiretrovirals for one person for 1 year.
Eight friends can get together and donate $10 each.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, if a person has to, if for some reason becomes resistant to their first line drugs, they have to go on second line. That's four times more expensive.
Oh, okay. Oh,
third line drugs is 8 times more expensive, up to $2,200 per person per year.
Is that something that happens often, where someone progresses within the disease that they have to go on to different
levels? It does happen. Mm-hmm. It does happen, and this is, I think, the concern we were talking about earlier in terms of people coming up with such advanced, you know, stages. You know, like, what has happened? Have they? Is it that they're off their drugs, or they never started their drugs in the first place?
Yeah.
And this is why the adherence counseling is so important. It's like helping people maintain their regime so they don't get resistant, so they don't have to go up to another line of drugs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
if that makes sense.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, as far as any kind of donations, if someone heard the podcast and they wanted to give to Doctors Without Borders, you mentioned, like, the medicine itself is a big factor as far as donations going to pay for those kinds of things.
Right.
Are there other things that donations that your organization would use, like treatments, programs?
All treatments, vaccinations, you know, programs, running, you know, buying equipment for clinics, you know, in some remote area, helping the logistics team set up vaccination drives in the middle of the bush, you know. You know, it's everything we do. It's everything we do. It's training our staff. It's paying our, you know. We don't run without donation.
How can maybe someone get involved, whether they have the skill set of the medical background or someone that doesn't? Is there a way for them to, you know, get involved within Doctors Without Borders, more so than maybe that monetary gift of the volunteer portion? How would they go about doing that?
Okay. Well, we're always looking for people to come work for us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the website is a good place to go to.
Okay.
I think it's www.doctorswithoutborders.org.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
If you Google search Doctors Without Borders, you'll find it.
You'll get it.
True.
It will say Doctors Without Borders MSF.
Yeah.
So
you'll get the international website, and then you get the different countries' website. You'll get Canada, you'll get the US, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously here in the US, you would go to the American website, and that's the best place to go. And then they would have a section of, you know, they'll be, you know, come work for us. Mm-hmm. And then it would give you some information about, you know, the types of careers we have.
And how to get involved.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Right on.
And you know, we do, of course, have you know, we need people in the financial section. You know, need finance people who know
how to run numbers.
Run numbers. We need logisticians to, you know, set up clinics and, you know, in the bush and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not just doctors.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that's
something people think. Doctors Without Borders, they're
that's
all
right.
doctors.
Yeah.
Like, well,
all
you
doctors
still need
managing
people
to
plan flights and set up
clinics
and get equipment,
exactly.
that kind
and
of
we need
thing.
So the website would be a good place for people to start.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So do you have any programs you want to highlight or upcoming events before we close up today?
Just to say that, you know, I think with just for people to know that, yes, we are emergency aid, but we do have these other different programs like our HIV programs. But currently, some of the bigger initiatives that we're getting into is, well, there's Yemen.
Okay.
They've just had one of the worst cholera epidemics in the world. It's been defined as the worst cholera epidemic in the world. There's a lot of malnutrition there right now, so where MSF is there. Also, we're in DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, with the Ebola, Ebola outbreak. And we're also involved in providing medical aid to the different areas in the world where there's mass migration.
Yeah.
So, you know, here in North America, but also in Europe. So, those are probably very current.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. issues that we're also dealing with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Excellent.
Well, Neela, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today and talking to us about Doctors Without Borders, MSF.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here, and I really appreciate the time.
Yeah. Thank you. So, thank you for coming all the way down.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Bye.
That was our interview with Neela Somaya. She's with Doctors Without Borders, MSF.
That was, listening to both Gloria and Neela is just, like, there's so many things that I don't know still.
Yeah.
And I feel really uneducated.
Yeah. Well, also, I
like,
kind of...
Like, they have all the, they have information, but I do feel like I don't do myself justice by knowing enough about AIDS and HIV prevention and how it works.
Well, yeah, I feel like it's not something anybody talks about
ever
anymore.
I feel like
anymore.
In the United States we just kind of forget about it for some reason, even though it's prevalent here. And
yeah,
it's
there
prevalent
are people
all
who
across,
have
yeah.
HIV and AIDS and they get it every year. Like, it's still new stuff happening.
It's not like it's gone away.
No,
we haven't, you know, cured it. There's no cure. It's just that now we have things that we can do to take these medications that they have to take every single day for years to just bring their rates to being low, or it to be lower.
Yeah,
it's just
viral.
And I'm a little like, wow, I didn't even know they were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I do have to say though too, like, Gloria is a doctor, and then I don't know if Neela would consider herself a doctor or not, but she's definitely a therapist.
Yeah.
So,
she's
counselor. So between the two of them, I mean, they have medical backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone is just like, man, you guys are smart and intimidating.
Oh, yeah. Go women.
Go women, right?
Yeah.
So I do have some stats.
Break it down.
Yeah. So I was, you know, of course, like, for Doctors Without Borders and World Vision, they have a lot of international stuff.
Right.
Like, they work internationally
Which,
a lot.
I will say I think is really cool is, even though they're international in our sense because they're not on the front lines here in the United States.
Yeah.
They are local. Like,
yeah.
You can't, they are a national program because they're in so many different countries.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, each of their programs, they work within a community itself.
Yes.
Which I think really actually brings them to a local program.
Yes.
More than a national program.
Yeah. So I did find some stats about HIV and AIDS that were international as well as local. Because I wondered if I would be able to find anything specific to Washington State. And I did.
Well, you're the best researcher on the team.
Thank you.
/all time. You are the GOAT. Greatest of all time.
Suck it, Tom Brady. So, as far as the history of AIDS and HIV, more than 35 million people have died of HIV and AIDS since the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported the first, as an epidemic. So they reported it in June of 1981.
Wow.
Sub-Saharan Africa is home to 15 million AIDS orphans. So children who's...
15 million?
15 million, yes. 15 million. That's quite a few people. Like, that's a ridiculous amount.
Oh,
so,
my God.
So, like, their parents have died or have been killed, and, like, AIDS is a big problem in their life. So 15 million AIDS orphans. So something else about not being talked about, like, I was under the impression that the AIDS epidemic reached a peak in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, you had mentioned having learned about, like, AIDS and HIV in fifth grade, and it was, like, the stigmas. You can still go to the same bathrooms and sit at the same tables as people who have AIDS. So according to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the 80s were not the epidemics, like the peak.
When
2005.
What?
I know. So the
How come you don't remember that?
Yeah. So the height of the epidemic, 2005, as many as 40.3 million people were living with HIV. So that's two-thirds of them in Africa.
What's insane is then thinking back to the statistic that Neela gave, where they also are dealing with most of them are dealing with TB or Hep C, and, like, think about, on top of all of that, like, that's...
So right now, we're in the 30 millions as far as, like, people who have HIV and AIDS right now, but 2005 was 40.3.
We're not too far behind.
Yeah, we're not too... It's not too much better. But every day in 2005, more than 13,000 people were newly infected with HIV. That's madness. And then there's a global plan that's supposed to help lower these kinds of statistics. And there are 21 global plan countries in sub-Saharan Africa. 7 of them have reduced new HIV infections among children by 70% since 2009. So that's great. So there's a number of countries: Uganda, Burundi, South Africa, Swaziland, Namibia, and Mozambique.
But yeah, that's madness.
That is, and what's incredible, so you talk about those countries, mm-hmm. and then think about the two that we met today,
mm-hmm.
they're doing it in those countries and other countries as well.
Yeah.
Like, there
Myanmar,
is,
right?
yeah, there yeah. is tons, there's tons going on.
Exactly.
To combat this.
So as far as the United States goes,
uh-huh.
An estimated 1.1 million people in the United States are living with HIV, and about 15% of those 1.1 million people don't know they're infected.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, it's a very important thing still to,
I think,
like,
that's
be
the thing,
aware
though, is, like,
of sexually
we don't
transmitted
even,
diseases.
We don't even really, like...
Or needle sharing.
Right. I think that's a big one, is that we don't even really talk about getting... Like, our country needs to talk better about getting tested.
Oh, yeah.
And we need to do more of the education and really stop putting a stigma on our own, saying,
mm-hmm.
like, it's wrong to get tested.
Yeah, no.
And whatever things, right? It's
yeah.
not even just HIV testing, but it's all things.
Exactly.
And so I think that, like, it's a step. Once you go to get tested, that's why doctors ask, like, well, let's test you for other things. I
yeah.
think that we need to continue that education and not force people, whether they're younger or older, to be like, oh, I don't have it. It's
yeah,
fine.
Don't talk about it as if it's this terrible, like, stigmatized
yeah.
thing. Talk about it like, this is your health.
Yeah, it's your health. And why
let's take care of your health.
Exactly. Why do we put so much shame to
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So in 2016, that's where that 1.1 million number
mm-hmm.
came from the United States. Southern states accounted for more than half of new HIV diagnoses.
Oh my gosh.
So that's something that maybe
well,
there's not as much education there as
yeah.
there is in the northern half of the
mm-hmm.
country, but, like, the southern states make up 38% of
wow.
the United States population, and they
and
account
then
for more than
that's
half.
Insane, because a lot of them probably don't know that they are infected, and they
exactly and they can transmit that
mm-hmm.
because they just don't know. Washington state wise let's talk quickly about that. So,
yes.
Department of Health has this report that is quite impressive. I was actually surprised.
Shout out to DOH!
Yeah, way to go. I was surprised that it's so all-encompassing.
Mm.
But they have data for 2017.
Mm. Wow, that's new.
Yeah, so by the end of 2017, in Washington State, over 14,000 people were estimated to be living with HIV. Approximately 91% of those people have been diagnosed.
Wow.
Neela had mentioned the 90-90-90 initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something that is an objective from the World Health Organization. The objective is to get 90% of all people infected with HIV knowledgeable. I know that I'm infected.
Mm-hmm.
90% of that population is being treated, and 90% of those people are on antiretroviral therapy, or they're being virally suppressed.
Okay.
So 90-90-90. You've got to
really
know that you have it,
yeah.
mm-hmm. uh-huh, and then you're getting your treatment,
mm-hmm.
and you're taking your actual medicine.
That's excellent.
So in King County,
mm-hmm.
2015, King County became the first urban county in the United States to reach the 90-90-90 objective.
Really?
Way to go, King County.
Wow. I didn't
so
know that.
So they reached that milestone 3 years ahead of when
mm-hmm.
they were supposed to.
That's
so,
excellent.
So
I hope
they're
that
doing
maintaining.
Great
yeah.
things. But in Washington State, King County is the biggest.
It is also the largest urban
It
area.
Is the largest populace
mm-hmm.
in our state. So as far as new HIV cases by county of residence from 2013 to 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 years. King County, Pierce County, and Mason County.
I was gonna say, like, this region, and I'm pointing.
Yeah, this
I'm,
is like
I'm
the
pointing
I-5
at like
corridor.
Yeah, yeah, is wow.
Yeah, so there's a high population in this area, and you can see
mm-hmm.
a little bit up towards Bellingham,
yeah.
but the regions that
corridor.
Are named:
mm-hmm.
Everett, Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, Spokane, Kennewick, Yakima, Vancouver.
Yep. So all of our real urban hotspots that
mm-hmm.
are in Washington.
Yeah.
But still, wow.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. A little bit about Mason County in a way, just because I feel like more people are starting to move down there
mm-hmm.
than previous years just
yeah.
in housing. But then I think that also brings up a point of what they talked about before is, you know, it's something that it doesn't just affect you as an individual. It goes even further
yeah.
Through your community and then how you're affected through
Absolutely.
That too.
So then for Washington State, new statistics for HIV cases. 2017, there were 445 new HIV cases
mm-hmm.
reported. Of those 445, 77% were men.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a big, big problem
it's
in the male community.
It's a big male thing.
Yeah, and some of it is between, like, say, pediatric stuff, like blood transfusions
uh-huh.
and things. There's drug transfusion,
uh-huh.
like drug sharing
oh,
needles.
Okay.
But it's still a really large problem
yeah.
in the gay and bisexual
mm-hmm.
community.
Yeah.
So of the 445 new cases, The age range is 25 to 34.
Okay.
So it's 36%. That's the biggest.
So the
25 to 34.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the biggest group that's being diagnosed with new cases.
Right.
As far as living with HIV, the biggest groups are older. So 45 to 54, 32% of people in that group living with HIV in our state, and then 55 to 64. So these are people who may have been diagnosed in the 90s or the 80s who are living with HIV.
Wow.
And there are 12,933 cases of HIV that are known in our state. So, and of course, again, 84% of those are men.
I did not know it was so lenient on one.
Yeah, I thought that it would be more of a 50-50 between male, female. And they do have statistics for transgender male, transgender female.
What, this is DOH's packet?
Yeah, yeah, and I'll definitely post a link to this so people can read this report.
Yeah, this is very interesting.
But with, between transgender males and transgender females are higher for new HIV cases and living with HIV cases.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to transgender males.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of like a strange...
This is really comprehensive.
Like it's one-sided, it seems.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like a 50-50 share between genders. So,
interesting. I had no idea.
I had
no
idea.
See, I feel like today I just learned a lot, which is good. But
which is the point behind World AIDS Day.
It is the point behind World AIDS Day.
Absolutely.
It was good podcasting with you, friend.
It was great podcasting with you, too. So we'll have to do this again sometime.
Do we have any upcoming events?
We do. And I would like you to think about next season because we have released to the charities who reached out before about getting on the podcast for season 3, the early bird charities.
Ooh.
We've released some of the episodes for season 3 and we'll be releasing all of those to member charities in the next couple weeks here.
Mm-hmm.
So people can definitely get interested. But if there's a topic you want to kick Philip off of, do it. Get that
Sounds
guy
good.
Out of here. Get you in here. Let's do it.
Get that guy out of here.
Get him out of here. So we wrapped up the last week to give. So
we
our
did.
Annual campaign, it does technically end on December 31st, but the last week to give wraps up December 7th. So we're just taking care of any of those fundraisers. That's right. Fact. Any of those fundraisers, any kind of things that are going on out there so we can get that those donations in and sent out to charities. There is an upcoming event called Stuff the Ruck.
Yes.
It's running like online from November 9th to December 11th, but the event is on the 13th.
It is, and it's cool. So the if you guys don't know what like a ruck race, a ruck march is, it's...
like the rucksack is
the rucksack of military.
Yeah.
And they are doing a race for Toys for Tots and the Puget Sound Honor Flight. And so any toys that are donated are going to go to Toys for Tots, and they're going to run around Capitol Lake in Olympia and then head up to the state capitol and get cheered on throughout the day.
I can't believe they're going to actually, like, they're going to haul the toys in the rucksacks, on their backs, throughout the city, around the lake, and then up the switchbacks.
Yes.
A race.
It is a Bernstein Bears book, which is, I don't know if you remember.
Oh,
I
remember
them. It's the night book, you know, where it's like they go out the window, down the tree, over the hill.
Oh,
that
okay.
One. You know what I'm talking about?
Nice.
It's my favorite book.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But back to Stuff the Ruck. It's going to be a really awesome event. And actually, speaking of, it is one of the health agencies that are doing it, too.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
So I know DSHS volunteers are really pushing it. So so that'll be on the 13th. It'll be here in the Capitol. In the finishing location is the Columbia Room in the Capitol on the 13th.
Some cocoa.
Yeah, so if you guys are in the area and you want to come down,
support,
see what's going on, bring a toy, feel free to do so.
Yes.
We're here all day.
Until 5.
Until 5. Then we have to go.
Okay.
So that is, that's it for this episode.
Of
World AIDS Day.
Ahead.
Yeah.
Woo.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you.